One of the great things about being a creative in the 21st century is that most things have been done already. There's a certain way of doing things. And once you understand the codes and conventions, then you can gain great traction by doing the opposite.
Hi, I'm Joel Pilger, and you are listening to episode 70 of the Rev Thinking Podcast. Today, my guest is Richard Holman, and our topic is creativity, love, and the power of ideas.
Welcome to Rev Thinking, the podcast for creative entrepreneurs who know the best way to deal with the future is to create it. This is the conversation between creative leaders and consultants, discussing what it really takes to run a thriving creative business.
All we need is love. That's a famous lyric we've all heard before. But after love, what is it that we as human beings need most? Well, my guest today, Richard Holman, has a theory that what we need most after love is creativity, and I tend to agree with him. In part, this is why my mission on planet Earth, which I have chosen to accept, is to support and empower the creative entrepreneur, because I believe the genius that you have is what the world needs. So this episode today, let's just say that Richard and I, we get on quite a groove talking about this topic of creativity, love, and the power of ideas. Now, Richard is an interesting soul because he comes from an agency and a bit of a TV network background. These days, he operates as, I would say, sort of a coach, a speaker, an instigator. He's a creative soul that does workshops and shares thought leadership and teaches groups how to produce better creative. In fact, I'm trying to find how he says it in his own words, because what he really says is he teaches these masterclass sessions, which are developed to rejuvenate and inspire creative teams. So this might be an in-house team at a TV network, but it could also be an agency or a studio. I'd say maybe a production company like yours. But his masterclass is designed to enable creatives and designers to achieve creative excellence. So if you're a creative, I'm just guessing that sometimes you struggle with coming up with great ideas. So something common to all of us as creatives. And I guess the question is, what do you do when you get stuck, right? Like, you know, great ideas are out there, but where do you find them? Well, that's one of the topics that Richard teaches. What about the art of a beautiful pitch? Do you have to pitch your ideas? Well, what makes a pitch more beautiful, more creative than the next one? What is a brand? What about the power of pictures? What about the power of words? Well, these are some of the topics that Richard speaks to. So I sat down with Richard here recently, a few weeks ago. He was at his home office in Wales. I was at, I believe, my home office here in the mountains of Colorado. And we had this really sort of intimate conversation. And it starts off a little bit lofty, a little bit woo-woo, philosophical about love and the power of ideas and what's the role of creativity. But then we get into some of this specific of where do ideas come from and how do we get better ones. So with that, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Richard Holman. Richard, what time is it in Wales right now?
It is just 25 to 5 in the evening. So I've dispatched my wife and children to the pub.
I was going to say, it's about beer 30 there. Do you have beer 30 in Wales?
We have 5 o'clock club in Wales, which is where my local in-laws and then a few friends sort of congregate in the Goose and Cuckoo pub.
Well, thanks for carving out some what I would normally think of as family or weekend time to be on the Rev Thinking podcast.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. I should be making up for it later on.
Okay, good. Well, good. You have to send us some pictures so we can share it with our audience. When you actually, we got finished and you went and had some fun, we can see what you're up to.
I will share my pictures later on. Yeah.
So I want to say, Richard, that I want to say you and I first got acquainted through your former business partner, Lucy, when you were guys were running Holman and Hunt.
That's right, yeah.
Which was, how long ago would that have been? Because I think I met her maybe 3 years ago. But how long were you running that agency in London?
We were running Holman and Hunt for about 3 years. We were policing and working together. And before that, I had an agency which I was running for about 12 years.
Oh, for about 12 years. And what was the name of that agency?
That agency was called Devilfish.
Devilfish. And was it London-based also?
It was London-based, yeah.
All right. And what was its focus? Because obviously Holman and Hunt was very much focused on sort of the broadcast and entertainment space.
Yeah, it was the same focus. It was the same focus, but it was bigger. The point at which I left, there were about 20 people there. So when I worked with Lucy, it was very much a streamlined operation, and that was how we wanted to play it.
Yes, the boutique agency, I presume.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Now, before that, you had a stint at BBC, so you spent a bit of your former life on the client side.
At the BBC, I was within the client walls, but I was making trailers there to begin with, and then by the time I left, I was writing their brand at BBC. So still very much involved in the sort of in the marketing side.
Yeah, sure. But what I like about that is at least you have that perspective of what it's like to live on that side of the table and live in that world of, shall we say, the corporate gig and working inside the big organization, trying to produce amazing content on a daily basis, right?
Correct. Yeah. There are a few places bigger in the UK than the BBC. I think they have 23,000 employees all over the UK. So
fascinating.
Yeah, it's a big operation.
So tell me now, I'm curious, what's your current focus? All of that experience that you have now has led you up to this point. What's your focus these days?
So my focus really these days is on inspiring people to have better ideas. I think if I was to formulate it in a single sentence. So I see myself as a bit of a creative catalyst. I think after love, creativity is maybe the most valuable thing we human beings have. And I've got to a stage now in my career where I spent kind of a lifetime working on ideas and trying to understand what makes a good idea and learning by success and by failure how to have ideas. And so I try and share that that knowledge today, and I do it by writing and speaking and doing workshops and doing a little bit of podcasting.
Well, we're fortunate enough to have you spread the love here with us today. And I love that idea you shared, because there's something actually very profound about that you, I think you said, after love, creativity is the most valuable thing we have. And I would have to agree, but I don't know if I've ever thought of it in those terms.
Yeah, I think I've done a project recently with ITV, so I still try and keep my hand in the game a little. So I've been working with ITV on their new brand identity. And the idea for that brand identity was to have, in the UK we have idents, which are little sort of logo animations for the programs. And the idea was to have a different artist make the ident every week. So we've got 52 different artists over the course of the year have been given a very, very open brief, which is that they have the ITV logo and they need to do something with it. And it's been an amazing project to work on for various reasons. Nobody's ever attempted to do something quite like this before, but to spend time with artists from all over the UK and kind of all walks of life and all different perspectives, it's just a really heartening thing, you know. And we are all brutally aware of the divisions, I think, in life at the moment and in society. And I think creativity has the capacity to bring people together. And I think television has the capacity to bring people together too. That's the sort of motivation, I think, for me doing what I do.
Well, I find that quite inspiring and really rather beautiful to understand a bit of your why, right? What makes you tick. And then on many levels, I can relate, because as for me and even our mission at RevThink, we focus on this subset of not only creatives, but creative entrepreneurs.
So yeah.
For us, we feel our calling is how can we help empower and unleash these creative entrepreneurs to produce their best work for the world? Because I would agree that the world next to love needs creativity desperately.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's very cool. I love that that context. When I think of creativity and where we are in the world today, and even especially in the world of entertainment brands and in television, the market has matured a lot. It's changed a lot. And some might say it's even getting dumbed down, or it's uninspired these days. Is that something that you would agree with, or do you bump up against that?
I do quite a lot of workshops with different TV companies and entertainment brands, and I work with the creatives and designers, and I have no doubt that the creative ability and the ambition is any less than it has ever been. You know, people are still full of ideas and desperately keen to make really good work. But I think we've seen kind of tectonic shifts in the landscape of entertainment over the last few years. And the power balance has shifted. You know, Netflix, Amazon, Facebook and Google, all making content. And nobody's really worked out the economics yet. You know, we used to have a system that with advertising and subscription that worked reasonably well, but the economics have changed. And this creates a culture of uncertainty. And I think uncertainty breeds fear. And fear is kind of anathema to creativity. A brain in a fearful state is anticipating danger. And if you seek to be creative, you've got to be in the present moment, and you've got to be in quite a sort of relaxed frame of mind, I think. So I think culturally there's a bit of a tension, you know, that the economic uncertainty and the risk makes people fearful, and it's difficult to make good work when you're fearful.
Man, well, I would agree, and I think there is a lot of fear that comes from the uncertainty and the shifts. At RevThink, we even have a newsletter that's published by Andrew Rosen called Earthquakes, and it just simply every week helps people understand the shifts and the, you know, seismic changes, as you call them, the tectonic shifts happening in the industry. And a lot of that does lead to fear, uncertainty, and especially if you're inside of a television network, you're not so much worried about whether or not the next season, the next show launch is great. You're worried whether or not you're going to have a job tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I suppose one of the things about the people that you work with, creative entrepreneurs, are people who by definition have embraced a degree of risk. I've put their necks on the line, and so perhaps they are, temperamentally well placed to play in this slightly uncertain playing field.
Well, here's where I would go with that, because I think you're right. They are comfortable with a certain level of risk. They are, in a sense, every creative entrepreneur is comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I heard something recently from an executive at ABC Television that I thought was really interesting. And I thought you might have a really strong perspective or opinion about this. And that is, he said, you know, Joel, your clients, these guys and gals that run studios and production companies, design agencies and so forth, they should be great creative leaders, but they're not. And there's a missed opportunity because they're great at so many things. But again, in this person's opinion, he said, I think they're really struggling to be great creative leaders. And I thought, well, I bet Richard would have an opinion about that.
That's interesting.
Do you think that there's a need in the world for creative leadership?
Yes. Would you allow me to expand on that? Absolutely. So he was saying the people running the agencies were
correct. Yeah, correct. I think his his assertion was that the agency leaders that come to him with, whether it's ideas, solutions, what have you, that they really need to step up their game in terms of being leaders that are driving great creative and inspiring great creative, not only from their teams, but from their clients. Yeah. And, you know, when I walked through your masterclass, the notes that you shared me about some of the concepts that you teach, I found myself really excited about the idea that there's actually a whole set of best practices around what it means to not only be creative, but how do you lead and inspire creativity?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the way I think about it is it's a bit like a benign dictatorship. I think is a problem in some places. So I see issues on either side of a spectrum. I see a bit of a spectrum. I think some creative leaders are too democratic. So they listen to lots of opinions and they canvas opinions and they're reluctant to take decisive action their own. And that means that you often end up with work which is of a kind of lowest common denominator because it sort of works for everybody. On the other extreme, there are those creative leaders who cannot give anything up, who perhaps believe a little bit too much in their own creative abilities and are utterly despotic. And I think for me, the best creative leaders that I've worked with are those who listen to all kinds of opinions and evaluate those opinions, but are then prepared to take decisive action. I think one of the good things about working outside of a big company and running an agency is that you become quite sharp, you know, because you have to constantly pitch and pitch yourself and pitch your agency and pitch ideas. And one thing I learned fairly early on was that as the creative director, people looked to me to call the shots. And sometimes you are not sure whether you're making the right decision, but you have to be decisive. So, yeah, I can see, there are not that many great creative leaders around, but I think it can be taught to a degree.
Well, tell me if you've ever been in this situation, because I think this individual at ABC, one scenario that I'm sure he's lived out, and that is, if you're a client, say at a TV network, and I've hired you as the creative director of this brilliant agency, and I see your creative, I see your ideas, and I say, okay, make the logo bigger, and I don't like red. Sometimes the agency answer is, yes, sir, get right to it. But a true creative leader is not always going to reflexively just do what he's told, that there's actually a higher calling and a higher purpose. The reason that you hire an agency, and even the meaning of the word agency, means there's some degree of independence and even sovereignty in the creative. Yeah. So in that situation, what do you do as a creative leader? Do you just bend over and do what the client says, or?
Well, here's how I have learned to deal with that situation over the years, which does come up. I generally, if they want to make it red, I will say, that's fine. We can make it red. And that takes any heat out of the situation.
So okay.
They're immediately like, oh, okay, I can relax. Because maybe they were a bit nervous about saying they wanted to make it red because we'd always talked about making it blue. So I say, it's fine. We can make it red. But can you tell me why you want me to make it red? And if I keep asking why, then usually there's a reason why they want to make it red. And as soon as I understand that reason, then I may be able to find a better solution to their, you know, the thing that is really bugging them deep down without having to make it red. Now, of course, that doesn't always work. And sometimes you just got to make it red. But I think it's easy sometimes when you've worked for a long time on a project you really care about, as the creative, to just sort of stonewall those requests. But if you go a little bit sort of Karate Kid on it, you know, and bend with the breeze, a little bit judo, then sometimes you can make it work for both of you.
Well, I think that's a smart approach, and I love that part of what you're saying there is simply being willing to have a conversation and ask why, help me understand your thinking and your reasoning. And I would say good clients are generally receptive to that conversation. Bad clients are the ones who say, no, just shut up and do what I tell you. And maybe that's a client you need to replace.
Totally. And that's the other thing I was going to say. I'm sure you found when you had your agency as I had mine, that you sort of gravitate to clients who are sort of simpatico, don't you?
Absolutely.
A similar way to you do. And then when you've got that, that's the most exciting place to be, because you both have the same level of ambition, but there's a mutual respect, which is critical, I think, in a fruitful creative relationship.
Now, here's what I think is really interesting about you, is I could sit here and walk through 100 different scenarios with you, and you've lived them like I have. You could give me all sorts of tips and techniques and so forth. But what's more interesting is that when I walked through some of the things that you teach in your master classes and so forth, was this notion that they're actually, these are coming from principles that you've recognized the patterns over the years, and that you really have sort of a framework for what does it mean to be creative? How do you inspire others to have better ideas? And that's part of what I'd love to unpack as we continue our conversation here. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds great. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think here's what I'll say first off that's kind of interesting. RevThink as a consultancy, we focus on these areas of creative business that we call the seven ingredients. And they're marketing and sales and production and finance and operations and so forth. One of those ingredients is the creative ingredient. But what's interesting is we rarely touch that area, because generally when it comes to a creative agency or a studio, that's almost their secret sauce. That's also where the competitive items often reside, where we can't really help one client, say, in a creative pitch, because it might be a conflict, because one of our other clients is also perhaps pitching the same piece of business.
Yeah.
But when I went through your content, I was really excited, because I thought, wow, here is a framework instead of principles for how to excel as a creative. But I want to ask a question to you, because when I think of taking creativity and viewing it as a process or as a method, that there's some sort of a framework or a pattern, I know some people are going to say, well, that's the antithesis of creativity, that creativity is just this willy-nilly, you can't ever pin it down, it's always new and different and special and shiny and so forth. But I think you have a different opinion about that.
I do indeed. I think my cat is intrigued by this part of our conversation.
Bring him in.
We're joined by a furry black thing. You'll know what it is. I can understand that. But I, having spent a great deal of time thinking about this and exploring creativity in all different kinds of media, I think there are certain principles which are universal, and there is something magic about creativity, and unpredictable and beautiful and spontaneous and elusive and all these wonderful things that we can't pin down. But I'm absolutely of the opinion that there are things one can do as an individual, as an agency, as an organization, to get close to that magic happening. And these are the things that I attempt to teach. So I think, you know, one thing is that people jump very quickly to an evaluative frame of mind. So they have a brief, and the brief requires them to come up with a creative solution. And as soon as they've got a credible creative solution, they begin to examine it and they go back to the brief. And they don't allow themselves the space to be carefree. And I think that's one of the first things that I, here's the cat.
Welcome.
Yeah, this is Minnie. And this is one of the first things that I try and teach. So it was a really interesting study done by Harvard Business School. And they've done this study a few times. And what they do is they get a group of creative professionals together and they give them a brief. And then they divide the group into two and they say to one half, you're going to be rewarded for the quantity of ideas that you come up with in this brief. And they say to the other half of the group, you're going to be rewarded for the quality of the ideas that you come up with. Every time that they have done this exercise without fail, it's always the group who've been told that they'll be rewarded for quantity that come up with the best ideas. So I think allowing yourself that space to just try and come up with as much stuff as possible and not worry about whether it's any good. And that's the thing. And it's so important to the creative process, because you're using a different part of your brain. The rational evaluative part of your brain is the prefrontal cortex, the thinky part. But the thinky part's no good for creativity.
Well, so if we were going to step back and look at what that study tells us, which I think is a really brilliant example. What's the pattern, right? The pattern is something called iteration is really valuable. There's a principle there that creativity isn't just randomness and that flash of inspiration, that there is at times a process or maybe it's creating the right environment.
Yeah.
Where iteration can happen and taking that step to iterate quickly, rapidly, push past the 10 obvious ideas to get to the 5 that are hidden and waiting to be discovered. But I think that's a great example, because you're right. There is a method of iteration that does tend to create better results.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, a mistake people often make is to assume great artists and great writers and great musicians are suddenly struck by inspiration. You know, the muse suddenly descends and an incredible novel or album or painting appears, when in fact, without fail, all the greatest creators really worked hard.
And, yes.
You know, it's about those hours that you put in and the time and the space to keep practicing the, whatever art form it is that you're working in.
Well, I'm being reminded of one of my favorite authors is Stephen Pressfield. And he wrote a book, I think, called Turning Pro. And it has this idea called, losers are the ones who wait for inspiration to strike. Professionals are the ones who show up and do the work. And there's a certain rigor and discipline to being a great creative. And it does fly in the face of this myth of the lone auteur that's in his ivory tower and he's waiting for inspiration to strike. And boom, he comes down from the tower and he's created the next Mona Lisa or other work. And in reality, just doesn't bear that out, does it?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think another important thing to say in this context is that the most successful creative professionals that I have ever worked with have always done something creative which isn't professional.
Give us an example.
when I do these workshops, I often ask, I've got a room full of creatives. I say, who does something outside of work that is creative? And I'm often surprised that only a few hands go up,
That makes me sad.
Yeah, it does. I think one has to, we're all in the business of ideas, and we want the good ideas to come. And there are certain things you can do with your time, as we've alluded to. But I think you sort of need to keep your creative soul top as well by having something going on outside of work that has no that for which there is no brief. You know, it keeps you alive creatively. And I think two agencies. You know, I've had my own agencies, but I've worked with some really great agencies. And one thing I've noticed that the best agencies have in common is they've always got side projects going on. You know, they do, whether that's making books or making animations or short films, they do something else beyond just the client briefs. And I think that's such an important part of professional creative life.
Well, I'll just second that because I know that the great creatives and creative entrepreneurs that I know, they tend to travel. They tend to be very well connected. They interface with a lot of people and they pursue a lot of ideas. And they do have some sort of a passion outside of work. So I also, and I remember one time a guy that ran marketing at Nat Geo said something interesting to me. And that is, he said, when I start looking at a new agency that I want to potentially work with, I want to see their passion projects and their personal projects as much, if not more, than their portfolio of work, because it tells me something about what makes these people tick.
Yeah.
I thought that was I think that's part of what you're saying.
Totally. And that's a smart way to evaluate agencies, I think. You know, personally and as an agency, to have a broader creative life, I think is really important.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about how you work these days, because we've talked about these meta patterns, if you will, that creativity, there is a certain method. There is perhaps a framework that one can apply. Now, are these things teachable?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is part of what you're spending your career on.
Yeah.
What does that look like? How does that work?
Yeah. So I am, you know, about 3 years ago, I was invited by someone I know to go in to a TV network and to work half a day a week with their in-house design team. And my friend, then client, she felt that her design team had some great people, but they were underperforming. And she'd not done much stuff with design, so she got me in. And I felt it would be remiss of me just to sort of turn up and chat. So I tried to structure each of our sessions. And each week I took a different kind of theme from, you know, where do ideas come from through to the value of making mistakes. I did a session on photography. And it was really out of doing that that I suddenly realized, wow, I've learned quite a lot of stuff over the years. And so my masterclass came about very sort of organically out of that, the experience of doing that. And for these sessions, I started building up material. And then as I sort of saw things or thought about things or read something, I would add to it. And so I've got this 6-day program now, so that's the sort of the full program, and but I do kind of shorter versions of it as well, and I tailor the course to particular clients' requirements.
Well, I love that story. That's so endearing because I can relate. I could tell you a very similar story about my journey of becoming a consultant, but it is true that the only surefire way to truly master a subject is to teach it. And when you're called upon to share your knowledge, your thoughts, it's like every time I speak in public at a conference, or when I lead a program, an accelerator, as I call them, there's this agonizing process that you have to go through of, well, what do I really think? What do I know? What can I teach? What are the principles? And it forces you to step back and see the patterns and organize them in a way that someone can actually digest them, receive them, and then act on them. So I'm guessing this is what your masterclass does.
Yeah, absolutely. What I try and do is build actual live creative sessions through the course. So we take briefs from the organization, and we work on those sort of strategic points during the course, so the people can put into play the principles that I've been sharing. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to comment. I just recently, earlier today, did a podcast with Tim Hughes, the Brief Doctor. You might know him. He's the London-based guy.
I know him well. Yeah.
And of course, all he does is work on briefs. But another great example of that there's, I'm sure you know, there's a process and method for how you even begin a project in something like the creative brief.
Yeah, completely. Speaking of another Tim, your partner Tim Thompson. I listened to Tim's stages of a creative career, and I think I think when one gets to I'm 46 at the moment. When you've been working in industry for around 20 years and you've been around the blocks and you've had some successes and some failures, you begin to know some stuff, and it's rewarding to share that with people.
Oh, no doubt. Well, especially when you know that the knowledge that you have, if you can somehow convert it so that it can be unleashed and help other people. And then, of course, I know in your case, we have this similar why that, like you said earlier, after love, I think you said creativity is the greatest thing that we've got.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it gives you a lot of satisfaction knowing if I can take everything I've learned and help people become more creative and succeed in their careers, then there's a terrific win-win there for everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely my aim. So I just started my own podcast, which I interview artists and designers and writers and makers about their own process to sort of demystify it a little bit, I think.
Sure.
And to sort of reassure people that that there are highs and lows with everyone, and I think you can look on as somebody who wants to make something at people who are already successful in that genre and think it came easy, or to not understand how tough it can be. And it's good to make creative people feel a bit like that we are we're of a similar mindset and ultimately we're coming from the same place,
We're all in this together, right?
Oh, yeah, man. Because there is a lot of division around, isn't there? So the more that can be done to bring us together around a shared endeavor, and the better. And I think creativity is maybe the best of those.
Well, for people listening or watching, since we are recording a video here too, I thought it would be interesting to even just quickly walk through some of the topics that you talk about, because I found just the topics intrigued me and made me say, gosh, well, what would that be like? How can I learn more of that? Because I noticed just your top line subjects were things like, here we go, great ideas and where to find them. Right.
Yeah.
That's one of those. Well, I think everyone could use that one. The art of a beautiful pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone knows, well, of course I could elevate my pitch game, especially the agency people out there, because they spend not only half their lives pitching, but most of their success, much of their success is dependent on pitches. And then how about this one? What is a brand? That one's, I'm sure you're unpacking a lot of, you're challenging a lot of assumptions, right? When you do that one.
Yeah. Yeah, that one sort of changes on a weekly basis, It's, depending on what people are saying about Simon Sinek and
yes, of course, the why.
Yeah.
And then I see the power of pictures, the power of words, and then making good ideas great. I think there's one more here. So social and innovation. So there's just great topics. This last one I see here about one show, 100 promos.
Yeah.
I thought, well, gosh, I know it's targeted for people at TV networks that have to promote a show day in, day out. And all they have are clips. So they're doing clip spots and they're trying to figure out how to do something creative for the 100th time. But I remember when I ran my agency, sometimes we were tasked with doing topicals and these daily promo volume. And we were in the challenging place of, okay, they went external for this day in, day out promo volume. How are we going to bring value every day? So I would have loved to take that course years ago.
Yeah, that one's a bunch of strategies that you can use to come up with a fresh idea for a property that you worked on a number of times before. So I have curated and collected some brilliant examples of oblique creative approaches and
oblique.
Oblique. Yeah,
I like that word.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a good one. I use it quite a lot. yeah, in my stuff, I think. I wrote an article about this recently. One of the great things about being a creative in the 21st century is that most things have been done already. And this means that codes and conventions have been established for nearly every category of communication.
Interesting.
There's a certain way of doing things. And once you understand the codes and conventions, then you can gain great traction by doing the opposite or flying in the face of those conventions. So I do, one of the techniques I teach is oppositional thinking. And the way that works is it's a really quick way of coming, of sending yourself off in an original creative direction. So what you do is you take the category that you're working in and you try quite quickly to list the conventions. So if you take a sizzle reel, you know that is normally a dramatic series of quick cuts. You know it's normally got a piece of contemporary music under it. You know it's normally like a minute to 2 minutes long. So you've got those and you say, right, okay, if I were to do completely the opposite, what would I do? So instead of a dramatic series of cuts, what if I do my sizzle reel in one shot? What is the one emblematic shot which encapsulates everything I need to communicate? Instead of it being 2 minutes, why don't I do it in a second? I'm going to make the quickest sizzle reel that's ever been made. I'm going to have a shot every frame, and the client's got to slow it down. Or what if I make the longest? So what? My sizzle reel is going to go on for 24 hours.
Right.
I'm going to bring a sleeping bag to come and watch my sizzle reel.
Or what if it's not one video? What if it's 20 videos that are each 2 seconds? Right.
Exactly. And what's quite interesting about this process is the ideas that you come up with are maybe not feasible and maybe are not that great, but you introduce a sort of playfulness and a sense of fun, a kind of willful obliqueness, which can lead you into a really interesting creative direction.
Well, you make a great point there. Again, this is that pattern, that methodology of everything's sort of been done before. And if you follow the conventions, you're, of course, going to create more of the convention. Yeah. So what are some of the approaches and methods for breaking those molds? So what's the usual response from a client when you teach this idea inside of a network where they're very resistant to change and they're afraid? Do they hear this and think, I'm going to lose my job if I recommend a 1 second sizzle?
Yeah, well, you know, clients are often reassured by success, previous success. And there are case studies of great advertising case studies where people have deliberately flown in the face of the conventions of the category and been successful commercially. So one of the examples I share is Mike Deaver's commercial for Halo Top ice cream. I don't know. Have you seen this?
I don't know it. Tell me about it.
So when you advertise ice cream, generally what you do is you either talk about the luxurious indulgence of the product, so the creaminess and the moment to yourself that you have as the ice cream slips down your throat, or you talk about the provenance. You talk about how happy the cows were that ate the grass in the countryside, makes the cream, and the farmer and his tractor. And Mike Deaver's Halo Top commercial is an elderly woman in a dystopian sci-fi future with a robot that's forcing her to eat ice cream.
Wow.
Yeah. And the robot says, "Everyone you love is gone." And I think that's pretty much the only line of dialogue in the commercial. It's an incredible piece of work. And I show this and it sort of blows people's socks off. But Halo Top is the fastest growing ice cream brand in the US at the moment. And if you look into the commercial story, it has this extraordinary explosive growth. And one of the reasons for that is the confidence that they've had in the way they've marketed the brand.
Well, you're reminding me another story of your of Guinness, that I read something in one of your articles about Guinness requires a long pour because it develops too large of a head. And this is a problem. So yes. When we sell Guinness, let's talk about everything else, but not talk about the problem. And you had this great point of this, actually the really successful campaign embraced the fact and somehow celebrated it.
Yeah, and I think it can be a really effective creative strategy can be to try and make the problem the solution. So for a long time, Guinness talked about Irishness and creaminess and these kind of things. But one of the biggest issues for Guinness was that in a busy bar on a Friday night, if you order a pint of Guinness, your pint of Guinness has got to sit there because they have a pour, which means that the Guinness has to settle. So it slows everything down. And an unconfident marketing strategy would be one which tried to sort of glaze over this as a problem. But about 20 years ago, BBH, I think, were the agency, they decided to embrace it. And they made the idea of the campaign to celebrate things that take time. And so they created a commercial which was all about surfing, and surfing is, as anybody who's attempted to surf will know, it requires a lot of sitting around in the water waiting for the perfect wave. But when the perfect wave comes, it's a beautiful thing. So, the strategy of making the problems the solution can often be bold and a little bit scary, but one of the most effective.
Mm. All right, so I'm curious because you talked about this approach. I think you called it oppositional thinking. Is that your term for it?
Yeah.
So that leads me to ask about this other topic that you is part of your framework, which is mistakes. Because sometimes oppositional thinking, I'm sure, can lead you down a path where that you might make mistakes. But I love that you talk about mistakes and that there's some sort of a value in making mistakes. What's the story there?
So I think it's a really good test of the creative ambition of an agency or an organization is to ask them whether they have made some mistakes creatively. Because I think if you want to make really great work, then you have to take risks. And if you take risks and keep on taking risks, sooner or later, you will make a mistake.
Yes.
So I think if you're not making mistakes, then you're not taking enough risks. And if you're not taking enough risks, then creative nirvana or, success or the thing that we're all aiming for will always be forever beyond your reach. Given that mistakes are, by definition, generally an unfortunate and unwanted outcome, how do you deal with failure? And as I've sort of alluded to, one of the reasons I think I'm able to talk as I do about the creative process, because I made my own mistakes. There are things that I've done that haven't worked out. So having the confidence to know that, if you take a risk, you might make a mistake. And so long as you're able to dust yourself off, learn from it, and then use that learning to do something better next time is really important, I think.
Now, let me challenge you to go even deeper, because that sounds like a topic that you could speak on, whether it's in a corporation, organization, maybe even at an agency. And everyone's going to nod and everyone's going to say, yeah, yeah, that's right. If we're not taking risks, then, you know, the only way we're going to really know that we're really taking risks is that every now and then we fail. Then when it comes time to take the risk, everyone says, yeah, forget about that.
Yeah.
Right? I think maybe my thought is there a short-term versus long-term equation? Because in the short term, taking a risk is very different than taking a risk that's going to perhaps have consequences for the long term. Like, how do you decide this is an appropriate amount of risk, or this level of failure is acceptable because it will, what it teaches us is going to be more valuable over the long term?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. It's a good question. And I suppose it's about level of risk, isn't it? As you say, and anybody who is a creative entrepreneur with employees has a duty, I think, to look after those employees and not sort of, bet the house.
Right. Of course.
And you probably wouldn't last very long if you did, but maybe this, you know, this comes back as well to the value of side projects. I think to having an arena in which you can experiment and do things which might not work out. So I think that can be a good arena for mistakes. The other thing I've found is that occasionally we talked about clients that gravitating towards clients who have a similar mindset to you. And I was lucky in both my agencies to find clients who I was able to work with over a number of years. And we, with those clients, occasionally we push things and we push things a bit too far. But because we'd had some really good successes and because there was that, that mutual respect, we were able, if there was an occasional sort of bump in the road or something didn't quite work out as we wanted it to, then that was okay, you know, because we knew each other well enough. I certainly wouldn't advocate for taking a big risk with a new client, for instance, unless gaining that client was not, you know, was not essential.
Well, I know a couple of thoughts I'm having is that, one, if you're a creative entrepreneur, there is a role of margin and profit. In other words, creating some cushion called we can afford to take risk because we have a 6-month runway of cash or these kinds of things. Meaning we can fail in some small ways that'll make us stronger and better. I know one other unfortunate reality that I've seen play out is, and I'm curious if you've seen this in the UK or in Europe, that here in the US as consolidation in the entertainment industry has happened. There are a lot of big TV network families that did IPOs and then they're now being monitored by Wall Street. Right. So what happens is their risk tolerance shifts from perhaps a year-long horizon to a quarterly horizon.
Yeah.
And so what happens is the client is never willing to take a risk that won't pay off within 90 days because we have to hit our numbers. And it really changes the dynamic where they're always like, well, if I take this risk and it pays off a year from now, I don't care about that. It has to pay off right now.
Yeah. And that's a really tough context. To be working in. I understand that. I mean, I think it sort of goes back to what we were saying at the beginning of our conversation as well about the sort of tectonic plates shifting. And my view on it is that there is a period we're in at the moment, which is very much a transitional phase, where the older players and the older models are still valid to a degree. So people are still operating to a degree as they've always done. But I think as we progress and as entertainment options proliferate, only those who are truly differentiated will succeed. So I think those who are rigidly adhering to a very short-term view are really only delaying the inevitable.
Yeah, I would agree. And I appreciate you referencing that a lot of what's happening, if you're in a creative industry and you create value in the world by producing creativity, you owe it to yourself to look at those tectonic plates that are moving, because they may not affect you today or tomorrow, but next month, certainly next year, they will. And, you know, a wise person is going to have their eye on those shifts. I mean, clearly in our world, especially in the US, the rise of OTT, you know, whether it's Hulu, Amazon, Netflix, Apple, and the like, has been a huge shift. And for people that are riding that wave, it's pretty exciting. Other people are just now waking up and realizing, oh, you mean there's a lot of business to be done in that world, but we've always worked for TV networks. We don't know how to reach out and engage with those people. I always encourage them, well, you're late. You better get on it.
Yeah. I mean, my view on this is that if you seek to be a general entertainment brand, then you're going to have to have exceptionally deep pockets. You know,
that's
the only way to stay in the sort of middle ground is to have an extraordinarily deep pockets. I read that I think Netflix has got $9 billion. Dollars of long-term debt at the moment, and then they have all the subscription revenue on top of that. So what this means for us as sort of creatives and agencies is that the brands that we work with, given that they're probably not got pockets as deep as Netflix, Amazon, Facebook, or Google, means that these brands are going to have to take a different perspective. They're going to have an original, refreshing and distinctive take on the world. And I think we as creative agencies on the branding side, on the creative side, can help them with that. And that's the sort of challenge is to take the truth of the brand and bring that truth to life in simple, surprising and original ways. And so in that sense, you know, this arena and this newly dynamic arena has a lot of opportunities, because I think we're very good. I mean, that's what we do is we take truths and we provide original takes on those. We bring those to life in an original way, and it's going to be a critical skill over the next 5-10 years.
Well, I would agree. I think I don't want to sound too Pollyanna or optimistic, but you're right. It's not that the industry is dissolving or disappearing. It's shifting. And right, like the consumption of content and story is at an all-time high. Yeah. I'm thinking of the classic book, Who Moved My Cheese? And how for those that have been stuck receiving the cheese from the usual conventional networks and providers and so forth, the cheese is moving. It's not that the cheese is gone, it's moved. So you have to go find it. And of course, the people that can tell those stories, can find those brands and help them stand out with a distinctive point of view, are going to excel over those trying to apply the conventional approaches.
Totally. Totally. And you know, I would say it's a sort of inviolable truth that people will always want to be entertained by stories, and people will always need a little bit of assistance to find the right storyteller for them. And I think that, you know, sort of the value of branding and creative agencies is, you know, lies in helping people navigate this extraordinarily rich landscape that we're enjoying now. So our skills are perhaps more necessary than ever. It's just that it can be quite a confusing and frightening place to be sometimes.
Well, it's amazing to think that if you and I were talking 15 years ago and you told me this is where Netflix is going to be, or Amazon, and these are the numbers, and these are the viewers, and this is the amount of new shows and series, we would have said, that's impossible. There's not enough appetite in the market for that much story and that much content. But here we are, and it's not, it hasn't run its course yet.
Yes, completely. And things will always change. I think at the moment, probably we are, and we're reaching a point where viewers, consumers, audiences need some help navigating through this vast proliferation of content available on phones, laptops, and tablets. And we're almost going to get into a space where we kind of need channels again. We need that level of curation. You know, we need brands who trust, who understand us and who we trust to help us navigate choice, which is, of course, where, you know, where branding came from in the first place.
Well, I always loved doing promo work myself because I thought of it as I'm telling a small story about a bigger story that you're interested in, and I'm going to help you find it, connect with it, navigate to it. And I always thought that was something beautiful that, you know, about the entertainment space is helping the world connect with the stories they care about.
Completely, completely. A nice thing, I think, about working in the space of entertainment brands is I think entertainment by and large is a good thing. You know, bringing people together to share and enjoy stories, and perhaps to share and enjoy stories which say something about us and who we are and our place in the world is valuable. We're not selling insurance or, you know, weapons or cigarette or any of these things. You know, we're promoting something which is fundamentally good. So I think that's cool. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I think that's a beautiful characteristic about what we get to do with this industry is try and make the world a better place ultimately by telling these stories that help us understand what we have in common and appreciate other perspectives and break down some of those differences that you talk about.
Yeah, and the best, you know, the I think a really good test of creative work is I call it the watch again test. It's where if you've seen it more than once, you're happy to see it a second time. And I think the best creative work, whether that's design or advertising, thinking purely in terms of the sort of agency field at the moment, has its own intrinsic value.
Yes.
You know, it makes the viewer's life a tiny bit better, not a big bit, but just a tiny bit better for being around, because it makes them laugh, or it makes them think, or it makes them see something they knew in a slightly different way. And I think that has to be the aim for all of us as creatives, really. And, you know, whether you're working on making the story or you're working on making the, you know, the commercial about the story, is to have that kind of intrinsic value. And I've always felt that, the entertainment brand should have branding which is itself entertaining. And I think it's a really good good bar to set yourself.
Yeah, that's a cool standard to say if you're an entertainment brand, your brand had damn well better be entertaining.
Completely. I want everybody who sees my work to be happy to see it more than once. And that's quite a good filter, particularly when you've got the script on a piece of paper and you try and work out whether it's one you should take forward.
Well, that's a really cool, I think, point for us to start wrapping it up. I have a couple maybe practical questions of one. I have to say, I'm just excited to have this conversation with you, and I'm excited to see if there's opportunities for our audience and followers to connect with you. I would love to put you on a platform or a stage or something at some point down the road, because I know creative entrepreneurs need what you have, this approach and methodology, this framework for how to develop and produce greater creative. So I just wanted to say thank you for sharing.
Thank you for sharing
what you've shared and for what you do.
You're very welcome, and I'll be delighted to join you on a platform at some point.
So tell us if people want to find out more, if they want to listen to your podcast, can you give us some pointers on how to find you?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest way is to go to richardholman with oneL.com. And on my website, there is, I have an outline of the masterclass sessions I do. There are some of the talks that I've given. My podcast is up there. I blog regularly as well. So people can sign up there for for articles. The podcast is called The Wind-Thieved Hat and is available on all the usual outlets.
And is the masterclass, is that something that's available to agencies, not just corporations and larger organizations?
It is indeed. So far, I've mainly done it with entertainment brands. I've just begun to go in and work with agencies, and I'm very keen to do more of that work, because I'd also be able to draw on some of my own, you know, experiences from running an agency. So
absolutely, you and I will have to talk more about that offline.
But, yeah.
But thanks for being on the podcast.
It's been a real pleasure, Joel. Thank you very much for asking me.
Well, I know I appreciated the invitation to come visit you in Wales, because that's on my bucket list. So I've got to get out that way here soon. So maybe I'll come out and have a pint with you, and we'll watch the Guinness slowly settle.
You must do that. 5 o'clock on a Friday. 5 o'clock club.
Sounds perfect. Sounds perfect. All right. Thanks again, Richard.
You're very welcome. Have a good weekend.
You've been listening to the Rev Thinking Podcast. For more information on upcoming accelerators, events, or to learn how RevThink advises creative entrepreneurs like you, connect with us at RevThink.com.
I want to tell you about a place to connect that you might not know about. It's our online community called Rev Community. It's a great place to get to know other creative business owners like yourself, to share some thought leadership and read other encouragement, to be challenged in this new marketplace, new technology, ideas, economic trends. And it's a place to research, check out many of the resources we have online, our videos, and of course, this podcast. Join us today at revthink.com/community. If you're a creative studio owner, feel free to join us today at revthink.com/community. I look forward to seeing you there.